We get the hour underway by welcoming to the program one of the most successful and prolific songwriters of the last four decades or so. He has written songs that have gone to number one on the charts eight times along the way. He's a member of the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the writer of, well, some of my favorite songs of all time, which carries a whole lot of weight around here. We're so happy to be joined by Pat Alger. Pat, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. You know, I'm a big fan of Maine. You know, I usually spend at least a month of my summer up there every year, except for the last unfortunate two summers hadn't happened. But
which part of Maine do you usually come to?
Well, I've been to quite a few parts, but the place I usually end up is near Belfast.
It's right near my house, Pat. This is Bruce. It's like right near. That's where I live. So
Penobscot Bay. Yeah, that's my favorite place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of mine, too. I live in Swanville, which is just outside of Belfast.
Oh, yeah. 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 I usually end up in sometimes in Sandy Point. You know where that is?
Yep.
And sometimes right there, just right outside of Belfast, about 5 miles and right on the bay. And
well, next time you're up.
It's a place where I've written a lot of stuff, actually. So it's a pretty neat place.
Next time you're up, we'll have to go to Young's Lobster Pound and maybe talk a little music.
Yeah, you know, I tell people, say, what do you do when you go up there? You know, I always say, well, what do you mean? Because I don't do anything. That's why I go up there. You know. I think I went once 10 days without having a conversation with anybody. It was great.
Well, that works in Maine. We don't find that odd.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I noticed and loved about it, actually. Yeah.
Now, Pat, I was reading through the impeccable source at Wikipedia that says you were majoring in architecture when you first started college at Georgia Tech. Is there a connection between architecture and songwriting? Because I can see that in some way.
Well, you know, I've thought about it. I actually have thought about that a lot. And I also studied graphic design. I was a graphic designer for a long time. And I don't know. I could probably name a dozen songwriters who are graphic designers also. I do believe it's something to do with, in the architecture thing, it's you know, you're making rooms, and then songwriting is about what happens inside those rooms, you know. And there is a kind of a connection. You're building something from scratch. I think that's the real analogy for me. I've had a lot of time to think about it, of course, but I think what happens is the act of creation is similar in almost every field, I think. I can honestly say that, you know, having had an education in the arts, it did nothing but inform my writing, absolutely.
Well, I like that a lot. As somebody who is a high school drama director, I love to see young kids get involved in the arts, even if they never do it again, because of the skills that they acquire from that.
Oh, absolutely. And I do teach lyric writing at a local college here, and I'm a consultant for their program. And, you know, often I tell them in the beginning, you know, I don't know how many of you are going to become professional songwriters, but being able to express yourself is going to help you for the rest of your life, you know?
Well, you know, I'm really interested to hear you say that, because beyond being a great songwriter in your own right, you've collaborated with an awful lot of really other fine musicians and songwriters. And I was thinking back to the days of the Woodstock Mountain Review, and I was just looking at all the different people that have been in that, and so many of them that I was fortunate to get to know over the years. If there wasn't the original songwriter supergroup, you know, I really don't know what is. When I think to myself that you and Eric Anderson and Rory Block might have been in the room at the same time,
well, we were.
You know, the Traumatic Brothers, who I so loved Artie Traum. And Sebastian and all, and Cindy Cashdollar and Bill Keith and all these guys. What was it like to have that many good writers in one spot? I know that happens in Nashville, but Nashville's a city. Woodstock's a small town.
Yeah. I ended up there kind of on a whim, really. I had passed through there on the way back from Newport Folk Festival in the 60s. And I just thought it was beautiful. And then, you know, same thing happened another time, and I passed through there again. That time I met Happy and Artie Trowne. And Artie and I really connected. And I was also in a duo at the time in Atlanta. And I sent him some stuff, and he was interested in producing us. And when that group didn't work out, he and John Harold actually encouraged me to come to Woodstock, you know, thinking that would be a better jumping off place for me besides Atlanta, considering the kind of music I was interested in writing and doing. And Johnny Harold especially encouraged me to come. And if you remember him, he called the Greenbrier Boys, and just one of my heroes, really. Well, the week I moved to Woodstock, he let me stay at his house. He didn't tell me he wasn't going to be there. He moved to California. So I uprooted my whole life to be near Johnny Harold. He moved to California. But the Trowns are like my family. They're both like my brothers. And losing Artie was a big loss for me. And he and I toured together for many years and made an album for Rounder. I definitely learned most of what I know about being a performer from Artie. Absolutely.
Artie once said to me that you were one of his favorite people he had ever worked with anytime. He said, I would play with Pat and go on the road with Pat any day. And said that in a room at a festival, in a room full of other musicians. And I thought, I'm filing that away. One of these days I'm going to meet this guy.
Wow. That is so nice to hear. You know, we really were like brothers, because we could fight like a cats and dogs, and we could also just forget about it the next day and have a great time. We spent a lot of time in a Toyota Corolla driving around America playing shows. And I have to say, Artie, the most frustrating thing about my success was I could never figure out a way to help Artie the way he had helped me. That was really probably the most frustrating part of it. I did sort of help him jumpstart a couple of albums with some seed money, but you know, I could never do for him what he did for me. He just gave me confidence when I was, you know, I didn't grow up in a very supportive environment. My mother's favorite expression was, don't get your hopes up. So you can kind of guess what I had to overcome. But, you know, Artie, from the very minute we started working together and became friends, he believed in me. And I still to this day credit that with any self-esteem that I managed to come up with. It came from him.
We're talking with Pat Alger here on Downtown. Well, the first big success you had was with our friend Livingston Taylor, one of his biggest hits, First Time Love, back in 1980. And then later on, you wrote another song that he recorded with one of his brothers. James, that guy, City Lights.
James Taylor, yeah. Well, you know, when a couple of songwriters cut your song as a songwriter, it's pretty cool, you know. That again was, I could probably draw a line back to Artie for that, because we opened a show for Livingston, Artie and I did, and we were warming up backstage, and I was playing this song, and he stuck his head in the door and said, what's that song? And I told him it was a song I'd written, and he said, well, I'm looking for one more song for my album. If you'll send it to me, I'll play it for my producer. And I went, sure, right, okay, sure. So I made this little, I made a little cassette back when boomboxes were the big rage.
Oh yeah.
I lived on 96th Street in New York at the time. If you know what a cross street is, it was where all the buses went. So it was the middle of summer. So you could not close the windows. So I made this tape with three songs on it. Cost me about 79 cents and plus postage to send it to him. And I got two pretty good size hits out of that little demo. There were three songs, and he got First Time Love and a song called City Lights off of that little tape. And If only everything else had been that easy.
You did great work with a woman we lost recently, Nancy Griffith, yes. Who was one of my favorite singers and songwriters. How did you two get together?
Well, I'm Woodstock Mounds Review, Jim Rooney, was just starting to produce records. He produced a record on John Prine, was doing, and also I think he engineered the first Alison Krauss album. He was just starting to get a little bit of a rep in that field, you know, as a producer. And a guy named Richard Dobson, who is a great Texas songwriter, is also no longer with us, unfortunately. Jim's still with us, I'm happy to say. Mm. Talked to him the other day about Nancy. He brought Nancy. Nancy came to a party at Dobson's house, and Jim was there. He met her, and he told her that I was playing down at the Bluebird Cafe. And I just written this song called Once in the Very Blue Moon with a guy named Gene Levine. And I played it that night. She came up to me right after and said, I'm going to cut that song in that twangy Nancy Griffith voice that she had. And I said, okay with me, you know. And I ended up playing on the album, and I toured with her for quite a while. And, you know, there's a lot of those early videos. I'm on those videos. And ended up playing on the first three albums. And, you know, wrote songs and had a song on every record. So it just turned out to be that we meshed. And again, a great songwriter who chooses to cut another songwriter's song. I mean, it's just like, I'm thinking this is just one miracle after another, you know. But we were sort of from the same bag, I guess you'd say. She was younger than me, but she thought like a someone from the 60s. And she had that sensibility. And those records were, those first three albums she did, Once in a Very Blue Moon, Last of the True Believers, and Lone Star State of Mind, were pretty unique for Nashville. They really were.
Well, Bruce and I were talking about this before the show, too. She signed the big deal and went on to MCA and made some very good albums, but I don't know that anything that she did ever matched the level of those early indie albums.
Yeah, Jim really, there's something that Jim Rooney does that's hard to describe. He gets everything, he gets the right players together, and he stays out of the way, makes sure everything sounds good. He knows when he's got a good take, and he knows when he doesn't. But the rest of it, he leaves to the very talented people he's hired to do the job. And in that particular case, everybody just got along so great. And we were recording up in an unusual studio that Jack Clement had up in his attic that had windows. I mean, you could imagine that nothing would be more distracting than, trying to make a record on a summer day where you can actually see outside and see what you're missing. You know, so we really had a great time. And the people that were on those sessions ended up pretty much being the people on those first three albums, even the one that wasn't a Rounder album, the other one. Lone Star was MCA. But Tony Brown, the guy who produced that album, was smart enough to hire the band that Jim used pretty much. Mm. And there was a consistent sound on those first three records. I think that's what you're almost hearing as much as anything. Plus, I believe her songwriting at that point was just absolutely kind of uniquely original.
I was wanting to ask you this question for a long time. Very late one night, sitting with Guy Clark on my back porch, I asked him this question. I said, you know, you've written some great songs by yourself and you've written some great songs with other people. When do you know it's time to say to somebody, I've been working on this and it ain't quite there? Yeah. And he thought about it for a second and he said, well, I suppose when you have one good line and you just don't know where it goes. Now, it was late. We had been up a long time. And I was wondering what your reaction to that is.
Yeah, well, you know, I got to Nashville like a lot of people do. And I was pretty much, I had co-written a few songs with a buddy of mine who was not a songwriter per se. He was a guy named Peter Kaminsky, is a famous fly fisherman. He's written a lot of books on fly fishing and also written a lot of cookbooks. He's a really great writer, but he wasn't a songwriter. But I used to crash on his couch a lot, so he'd hear me searching for those two lines that you're talking about, and he'd just throw them out at me. And, you know, so he's on First Time Love, actually, a small piece of that, because he threw out a couple of key lines. And for me, when I got here, everybody said, well, you got to co-write, you know, or are you going to write, you know, do you want to write with me? I mean, people were, Once in a Very Blue Moon, for example, a guy that I wrote that with, I was renting a house and something happened to the plumbing, and I called a plumber, and this guy comes in and sees my guitar, and he says, are you a songwriter? And I said, yeah. He said, well, would you write a song with me? And I said, well, let me see your plumbing first. You know? And I ended up writing three pretty big songs together. And he was a plumber by trade, but he was also a songwriter. So I just jumped. I figured I was in Nashville. I'd just jump in. And I literally would have written with, you know, somebody's grandmother, I guess.
You teamed up with a friend of our show and Bruce's friend, Fred Kohler, to write what became Kathy Mattea's first number one song, Goin' Gone.
Yes. Now that was, you know, that was, when I came to Nashville, I knew two people. I knew Jim Rooney and I knew a guy named Bill Dale. And Bill was an old friend from Atlanta. He had also been a performer there, and he'd moved to Nashville to see if he could make it. But at that point, the time I got there, he had pretty much put that on the back burner. And I was trying to write songs with people. I said, well, you got anything you want me to work on? And he pulled out a sort of a early version of that chorus and played it for me. And I think it might've been the first meeting I was going to have with Fred. I just pulled it out when I went over there, and we wrote it pretty quickly. And Fred at the time, Fred was the guy who booked the demo. Fred did a lot of really pretty quirky demos.
Yeah.
I was not much on demos. My idea of a demo was for me to sing into a microphone, give a pretty good performance. Because I would always come up with the riffs on the guitar. I was a guitarist. I played guitar on a lot of my hits, actually. And so I would always come up with the intro and sort of the groove and everything. And I just do it myself, or I might have a piano player play with me and a harmony singer. But Fred liked to putter around as a producer. And my recollection of the demo is that it sounded awful, but it might have been fine. I don't know. Anyway, when we played it for Nancy, she really liked it. And Kathy heard it from Nancy's record. You know, that's how she heard it.
And you wrote another one of my favorite Kathy Mattea tunes, A Few Good Things Remain.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story, too. I wrote that with her husband, who played it for her, I think. And I don't think she had any reaction to his. He did a demo, and I did one, too. But he played her demo, and I don't think she had any particular reaction to it. And then I played it for Alan Reynolds, who is, you know, her producer.
Right.
And really, Alan is he's the song man. Plus, he's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, too. So he really liked my version of it. And he played it for Kathy. He handed her the tape, and she looked at it, and she said, are you pitching this to me? Because she remembered that John had pitched it to her. And she, anyway, it just worked out. It just worked out, and it was one of the most unusual records of that time. I played the guitar on that record, and the only thing on that record is me playing acoustic guitar, one track, note overdubs, a bass, Bruce Bouton on pedal steel, and drums, and Kathy sang it live, and it was almost unheard of to have a record at that unproduced, you know, and it just worked. It's a beautiful record.
Another collaboration that's been extremely successful for you is your work with Garth Brooks. Four number one songs that you've worked on with Garth. How did you two guys get together?
Well, I had a when I first came to Nashville, it was really my last stop, I guess. I had already been to New York, Woodstock, Boston, Atlanta. I wasn't going to go across the Mississippi River. I just wanted to go into California. So when I got to Nashville, it was pretty much the, it's going to happen here. Or I'm going back to designing books, you know, or something. And by that time, I had tried to get somebody to sign me to a publishing deal so I could, I had a son and my wife worked and we were barely making it a living. I didn't want to go back on the road with Artie. So anyway, what ended up happening was Jim Rooney and Alan Reynolds, these two producers, started a publishing company. And I went over and I literally begged them to just let me be part of it. You said, you don't have to pay me. I'll give you. And I gave them the publishing to go and gone. And one day I was coming out of one of the offices over there at that publishing company, and Alan was coming out of his. And there was a guy there who was dressed in a duster and the boots and the, you know, creased jeans and a pretty good size hat. And I looked at him, I kind of went, he looked like he was about 6'4 to me. He's not, he's about my size. He's about 5'11 maybe. And I thought he was working with John Wayne. That's what I thought. So he introduced me to him and said, this is Garth Brooks. I'm thinking of, thinking of doing some work with him, but he's a really good songwriter. Maybe you guys ought to get together. And, I'm a pretty hard-headed guy. I like to kind of make those decisions myself. But this one time I went, oh, really? And it turned out he was playing that night. And I went down to see him. And he played a song called If Tomorrow Never Comes that he'd written with this friend of mine named Kemp Lazy. And I went, man, if that's what he's doing, yeah, let's get together and write some songs. And, he was just a guy named Garth Brooks from Oklahoma then, though. We were actually pitching those songs for other artists. And the Thunder Rolls got cut by Tanya Tucker first.
Right.
And What She's Doing Now got cut by Crystal Gayle first. And Alan was getting really annoyed. He was trying to make a record, and we were pitching our songs like they weren't going to end up on the record. But thank goodness. I mean, you cannot really grasp what it's like to have been part of that. I still can't grasp it, honestly. It's overshadowed every other thing I'd done completely, I'm not complaining about it, but I mean, it's so huge that it's hard to fathom it. I kind of backed away from it. It was just a little overwhelming.
As he did too, and I give him all the credit in the world for, I mean, this guy was at the absolute top of the game, the biggest selling artist this side of Elvis, and just decided to walk away because he thought it was important to be a dad.
Yeah, no, he's a unique person. I've often said this, that he's the only guy I ever met who was prepared to be famous, because he took it as a responsibility, not just an opportunity. I mean, most people take fame and fortune as an opportunity, just do what the heck they want. But he was really had a sense of responsibility to the audience. And if there's another side to him that's phony, I've never seen it. And not even for a second. He's just what you see there is what you get. And I've been with him in all kinds of situations.
It has been an awful stretch in music here in the last couple of weeks with Nancy Griffith, the great Tom T. Hall, Don Everly. You opened for the Everlys for many, many years. What was that experience like for you?
Well, the Country Music Hall of Fame did a thing. They have a program called Poets and Prophets, and they'll feature a songwriter on a day and have a career retrospective, and it's an interview, and you perform, and other people come and perform. And the guy was interviewing me about stuff like that. And I started to raise the name Jim Rooney again. I said, look, basically, if there's no Jim Rooney, there's no Pat Alger, you know, because once again, I think pretty much the first week I was in Nashville, we went to get some lunch at Brown's Diner, which is a famous burger joint here. And sitting at the bar was Don Everly, and he introduced me to him. And I had the temerity not to ask him anything about the Everly brothers. I never did. And we had some common interests that had nothing to do with music, and we just became pals. He had a band called Don Everly and the Dead Cowboys, and he knew that I was a performer and a songwriter, and I was supposed to play at this club called The Sutler here, and the guy canceled, and he stepped in and filled in, and then it went so well that we ended up doing every Monday for a long time there. And when the Everly Brothers did reunite in 84, I pitched a song to him that I'd written with my friend Rick Beresford, and I was one of the only unknown songwriters on that EB84 album. Everybody else was like Paul McCartney,
right?
Mark Knopfler, and all those people. And so evidently, some comedian was scheduled to be the opening act for that tour. And about 10 days before the tour, he canceled. And Don called me up in kind of a panic. He said, would you do me a favor? And I said, why? Of course. He said, would you open for the Everly Brothers for a while? And I went, yes, I will. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. And he said it was just for a few weeks till we can find somebody that, you know, I guess famous is what they're looking for. But after about 3 weeks, they both came to me and said, hey, this is working out really good. And I ended up doing the entire 84 world tour and the 85, did all that. And then for every year through 80 through 93, I did a portion of the tour. And it was just, again, like it's kind of like meeting Garth Brooks. You can't really understand what the Everly Brothers meant to people. Mm. And the fact that they had not been together for a decade, and suddenly all these peoples whose lives had been changed by that music, getting to connect with it again, and I was very concerned that I was just going to be booed off the stage from stage to stage, from coast to coast. There's Pat Alger going again. But they embraced me. I worked up a little act. I actually did a couple of Fred songs. I did Let's Talk Dirty in Hawaii. Yeah. Yes, you probably know that song.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to tell you a very funny story about that.
Another one called Shop Shop that I did. Yeah. And then I did a bunch of my songs, and I had one Buddy Holly song. And I had the song that was on the Everly Brothers album. So I had enough entertainment value. Plus, I just had to go up and do 30 minutes. And what they loved about it was there was no changeover. I sang in Don's mic, played my guitar. You know, this is the kind of stuff that happened on that tour. George Harrison came backstage at the Hammersmith Odeon in London and said, how do you get that sound on your guitar, mate?
Wow.
Oh, well, step over here, my friend. So it was just an unbelievable thing. And then Don and I, we were good friends for a very, very long time. But as you know, people get onto different things. And I hadn't seen him in a while. I have to say, I was just heartbroken to hear that he died. And the guy that called me to tell me, I saw his number come up on my phone, and I said to my wife, I said, Don Everly's died. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to answer the phone. But he was a very kind man to me. And Phil was just about the nicest fellow and one of the funniest guys I ever met in my life. I rode on Phil's bus. There was a Don bus and a Phil's bus. Don's bus was about the same temperature as the crisper in your refrigerator. I couldn't take that, so I rode on Phil's bus, and we had so many laughs, I just can't even tell you.
Well, I have spent a lot of time over the weekend listening to a couple of your solo albums, True Love and Seeds, and it's so often the case, To me, nobody does a song like the person who wrote them, and I love your versions.
Appreciate that. I have a new album. I finished it just as the pandemic was beginning, so I kind of thought, well, what's the point of putting this out at this point? You know, I mean, what am I going to do? I'm not going to be able to promote it. But I am going to go ahead and get it out. Hopefully, my birthday is next month. I'm going to go ahead and try to get it out for my birthday, and I'll be sure and send you a copy.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to that. Pat, we could talk with you all day long. This has been great. Thank you so much for making some time for us. I hope we can do it again down the road.
Yeah, anytime you want to, man. It's like I say, Maine means a lot to me. I just texted my old roadie from my band, one of my bands in Atlanta, Bernie McDonald. He lives there in Bangor, I believe. And one of the girls that one of the women that I wrote a lot of my hit songs about lives down in Ogunquit, and hopefully they'll both be tuning in.
Well, and if you're in Belfast area and you've got time, come up and visit us in the studio. I'll drive you up and buy you a lobster.
Oh, that would give me something to do.
And if you don't want to have any conversation, yeah, we can just sit here and stare at each other.
It's great. It's just Maine is. You really hit on something. I could go to a bar there in Maine. I didn't go very often, but if I wanted to go to a bar and have a Guinness at the bar, and sit there, there wasn't going to be CNN on TV. It's more likely to be the Little League World Series.
Right.
And nobody's going to ask me what my view on wearing a mask was, you know.
You got down to the Front Street Pub and nobody will bother you.
That's right.
Well, Pat, thank you so much. Look forward to hearing the new album. Be well, and we'll talk with you again down the road.
Okay. I tell you, when it comes out, we'll do another interview if you want.
That'd be super.
We'll make a day. Thank you, Pat.
All right. Thank you.
That is the great Pat Alger here on Downtown.